I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Tom Stevens. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Michael. Great to be here with you.
Well, it's lovely to see you again after such a long time. You've obviously been busy. Perhaps I can try and sort of suss out how busy you've been by asking you, what is that you are holding in your right hand?
Well, Michael, it's a book, a recently published book, yet to go on sale, but soon to go on sale, of the Marser Diary. And the Marser Diary is a story that has emerged out of the archives of the New Norcia monks, which describes the arrival of the first large group of Benedictine monks from Spain in 1849.
It's amazing. I should disclose to our listeners that I spent 1 year at high school at St. Ildefonsus College in New Norcia in 1962, Tom. But I did not hear about this story when I was there. I'm sure there would have been some old monks who probably could have been interrogated. But what's the name of this ship?
The ship is Ferrolana. It's a ship that was constructed in the port of Ferrol in 1847. They started construction. And it was the last of the full sail ships to join the Spanish Armada. It was a grand ship. It was a warship, and it was a ship of which the Spanish Navy and the Spanish nation were extremely proud upon its construction.
Well, let's just try and get a few sort of facts and stats going here. You started with some of them about the ship and its size, and it was a warship, not just a trader or passenger ship. But when did it arrive here?
So it arrived on the 29th of December in 1849. The first that the people of Fremantle knew about it was when they saw it drop anchor out on Gage Road and it opened fire. It started firing a round of their cannon shell, but 21 guns were fired. And around about that point, people looking at it were looking at a Spanish flag flying, firing guns. It was a source of considerable alarm in the early days of Fremantle, and rumours quickly spread, what on earth is going on with this warship?
Well, it wasn't so long since Nelson had been sort of tussling with the Spanish.
Indeed, friendship with Spain was slowly emerging and hadn't settled down completely. There had been some new friends formed between Great Britain and Spain, but it was still a testy relationship in many parts of the world. But here in Fremantle, people got quite a shock at the sound of 21 guns firing from a warship.
Well, can you imagine? We're in the west end of Fremantle talking about this, and just down the road, around the corner and up the steps, you're at the top of the roundhouse, which I think had been built by then. So you're looking out and you're seeing this, what a sight. Guns blazing, got your little telescope out on the right eye, and you're seeing the Spanish flag, you're thinking, my goodness, what's going on? Are we being invaded? So what happens?
That's exactly what was going on in the minds of the local Fremantle people. Mr. McBroom, the harbour master, eventually works up sufficient courage to go out to the warship and to speak with the captain, a Captain Quesada, a very distinguished Spanish man who was fluent in English, who was able to disabuse them of any fear of the ship. He was simply giving his courtesy recognition of what he took to be a garrison town. He mistook the roundhouse for being a place where there would be cannon fire that he was expecting would reciprocate with the 21 guns to welcome the ship. And there was some speculation that there'd been offence caused by no reciprocal cannon fire. McBroom explained not only didn't they have sufficient cannons to fire 21 guns in return, they didn't have enough gunpowder either. I mean, Fremantle was not well set up in those days, and it was a small population, but mostly a trading community. And they were doing their best to respond to the arrival of a Spanish warship that the commander of which was a man full of of great dignity and carried himself with great bearing and was very interested in appropriate protocols.
So we don't hear of that many ships coming to Perth flying the Spanish flag. Do we know what number ship it was and why was it here?
So it was the 110th ship to arrive in the colony of the Swan River Colony. The 109th was the Mary, which had brought the first of the bride ships. And the 111th, to put it in context, was the Sindian, which had brought the first of the convicts into Western Australia. The 110th, this one, coming from Cadiz direct, 84 days it had taken to sail from Spain to Western Australia. A fascinating story. We're used to stories here in Western Australia of ships. We've got embedded in our consciousness, but sometimes operating a bit like state secrets when it goes to the rest of the world. Ships like Batavia and Catalpa and the Crate, and even the Parmelia, they're all ships that we know a lot about, but the rest of the world takes a while to catch up. And one of the ships that I think increasingly will be embedded in the emerging consciousness of Western Australia is this ship. Ferrolana was a ship assigned by the Spanish government and the Spanish crown, Queen Isabella II, to do a circumnavigation of the globe. And it was to set out and fly the flag of Spain and to, if you like, show its strength of its navy, because it was a grand ship, and simultaneously create opportunities for diplomatic discussions with the governments of the now independent former colonies of South America. And they were going to drop in around South America and to other Spanish colonies and British colonies around the globe. Something intervened in that, which changed the way the ship operated.
Well, if you're going to pop in South America and say hello to the colonial successors, you would have left Cadiz and gone west.
Indeed.
Fremantle isn't exactly west, it's probably due south.
So that takes us back to perhaps the start of the story. And that's where we have, as you've had on your podcast, explanation of the arrival of Serra and Salvado, the two first Benedictines that arrived and established New Norcia in 1846. They were consecutively sent back to Europe in 1848, went Serra, and he went back with the task assigned to him by the Catholic Bishop of Perth to go and find some more missionaries and resources to support the Catholic endeavours here in Western Australia. He was successful when he was over there, Serra, in gathering up a very large group of missionaries, but he had the task of working out how to get them from Europe to Fremantle. And he first tried to persuade the King of Naples to give him a training ship and bring the missionaries down with him. Unsuccessful in that endeavour, although the King of Naples gave him a few things, but not a warship, Serra turned his attention to Queen Isabella II. She was only 18 at the time, and she was apparently quite easily persuaded, and she in turn persuaded her government to give Serra the opportunity of bringing his missionaries on board the Ferrolana. And so the orders for the Ferrolana were completely reversed, and instead of going, as you would have said, go across direct from Spain into the Americas, he was to travel now down from Cadiz down the African coast and pop into Fremantle with 40 missionaries.
What's surprising me about this story, and it was Peter Burke's book, The Silk Merchant's Son, which, as you say, people find on the Shipping News, a great podcast, and he tells, it's a historical fiction, but it's a damned accurate one when it comes to things that happened. You've got these Spaniards here. What were they doing here? Did the Pope or the monarchy in Spain just believe they needed to get out and proselytise, or what was it, Tom?
combination of things going on all at once in Europe, but focused by Salvado and Serra, who had been preoccupied with the degradation that was happening for the Aboriginal people with whom they had been working and living at the Moore River. They'd spent a couple of years there upon arrival and had seen the impact that colonial settlement was having upon the Aboriginal people, and were really wanting to find a way of equipping the Aboriginal people with the capacity to protect themselves in the colonial society that was going to go into larger numbers than they were at that time. That they initially started to move around the bush with the Aboriginal people in a very peripatetic way, but they both became convinced that that wasn't going to work as a way of equipping Aboriginal people with the skill sets that they would needed to protect themselves. And they formed the view that a monastic mission settlement would create the opportunity for training Aboriginal people, for delivering education, and delivering the opportunity to utilise the land in ways that would link Aboriginal people to the economic development of the area. And through that economic development pathway, they wanted Aboriginal people to be able to protect themselves from the worst excesses of colonial settlement and the quite frankly, the murderous and barbaric behaviour that some of the settlers were engaged in, murderous and well documented. But that's not the only motive. They were preoccupied with evangelisation. The Catholic Church had a complete self-confidence that the pathway to heaven was by Catholic baptism, and people were wanting to share what they saw as being their particular gift, that, and they didn't want to be possessive of this gift. They wanted to share it with others, and so they came out, as some people would say, filled with good intentions, which is often the pathway to hell.
It is interesting. People often forget that the middle of the 19th century is the middle of the 19th century. The Spaniards had been doing this sort of thing for centuries. They'd been in South America for a long time. They controlled the Philippines. They were here, there, and everywhere. Hadn't made it here. They even had, their eyes on the rest of the world. So it's fascinating that they were coming out here. The missionaries had all of those motives that you've described. So Salvado and Serra turn up in which part of Spain to recruit, and how many people do they recruit, and how do they go about recruiting?
Well, they were great, great at the pulpit, the two of them were. Firstly, Serra, he moved around Spain and from town to town, spoke in the churches, and very quickly attracted a following and covered in the Spanish press that is available these days online. You can go back and look, and you can find and see him turning up in various churches around in places like Barcelona, his own hometown of Mataró, just north of Barcelona, down in Valencia, and up to his old monastic community at Santiago de Compostela. So he travelled around.
Well, people go on sort of pilgrimages.
Indeed.
Up there.
There's a wonderful additional connection that on that boat he managed to bring with him four bells from Santiago de Compostela. And when the boat landed and gradually getting their goods off the boat, here in Fremantle, they offloaded in December 1849 four big bells from the monastery of Santiago de Compostela, just near the cathedral there, and that the pilgrims regularly walk to and past. It's an additional fascinating connection between this boat arriving and that part of Europe.
And Western Australia. Now, just go back for a moment to the book that you're still holding there. And the diary, and how do you say the diarist's name?
Well, I'm not a great Spanish linguist, but I have it as Francisco de Asís Masa y Amigo, The combination of Francis of Assisi, Massa being the surname of the father, Amigo the surname of the mother, joined by the Catalan I.
But it's all in English. How does that happen?
So we've been, amazing story here. So Massa writes this diary between 1850 and 1853, the years that he was here in, 1849 to 1853. He is what they call a no persevero. He did not persevere as a Benedictine missionary and went back to Catalonia, to Barcelona, his hometown, and his diary disappears from anyone's knowledge, but by about 30 years ago, from the way I can put it together, his diary turns up in a Barcelona bookseller's...
This is presumably a handwritten...
A manuscript in Castilian Spanish.
Amazing.
And it's discovered by a bookseller who puts it on his for sale list. And it's spotted by an American bookseller who says this is interesting, and he buys it and then tries to on-sell it, successfully on-sells it to a Mr. Conti, who happens to be a Californian food and wine and oil connoisseur who knew about New Norcia because of his interest in fine olive oil, and knew that New Norcia had produced some of the world's good olive oils. He buys the diary. He has some knowledge of Spanish and recognizes it for its great usefulness to the monks of New Norcia. And so he gave it to the library, I think now about 20 years ago. And down the track, the monks have been outsourcing the translation of their various important books and documents and diaries and letters. And on this occasion, they put it out to an award through the Abbot Spirit Fellowship, which was picked up by Marta Perez Ray, who works at the University of Western Australia. And she has done a brilliant job of translating from the original Spanish the diary, and has presented that translation to editorial work being done by Peter Hocking, the archivist up there at New Norcia. And they have combined to now produce a book that is being published by Abbey Press.
So, Tom, going back, we'll just call him Massa, the diarist. He comes out as a Benedictine monk, or intending to be.
He had been robed as a Benedictine in the basilica down on the foreshore in Barcelona. He wanted to be a Benedictine. Did not persist with the Benedictines.
But he's one of how many who come out in the same sort of boat, excusing the pun?
On that first group, there were 40, 22 of whom were Catalan, 8 of whom were from Naples, Neapolitans. The rest, or other than one Irishman, the rest were Spaniards. But the majority of the payload of missionaries were Catalan.
It's such a great story, and even though it's known, it's almost not known, not just in Western Australia, but around the country.
Indeed, it's not a well-known story, but it's a great story in particular for Fremantle, because there are so many little aspects of it that weave in the Fremantle connection, even though they're just simply insights into the early days of Fremantle. For example, when they were... getting off the ship, they immediately, so the diarist records, stumble into a group of Aboriginal women and girls, Aboriginal girls, on the beachfront as they're coming in off the warship. And that intrigues the diarist to the point of recording seeing them and being expressing surprise. They're clothed, and he was not expecting that. They've got this perception of some sort of natives in their primitive state, and dress was not expected 20 years after colonisation or colonial settlement. The Aboriginal women on the beach here in Fremantle were dressed to the surprise of the missionaries. But the missionaries then wander around the corner from the beachfront to Henry Street and set up a camp there in a building that had been purchased by Bishop Brady, the Catholic bishop, and had set up a small convent and school there on Henry Street in 1847. The Mercy Sisters were living there and teaching there for a brief period, but he had shut the school and the convent down in the beginning of 1849. The missionaries moved in there, and that was their first night on land. All of them, or most of them.
We're looking out on Henry Street, just out the back here.
It's indeed, amazing, around it. I mean, that the particular building site is the now the medical school entrance for the University of Notre Dame. Their neighbours were a flock of sheep that were owned by Patrick Marmion on a block of land that he got permission to occupy and graze his sheep, owned by Bishop Brady. It was a block of land that is now, or became, the Emerald Hotel for Patrick Marmion, but which was, which is later now, of course, the Orient Hotel site, and that was at that stage just a paddock for a few sheep that was next to the missionaries. It throws an interesting glimpse of the way Fremantle was when they arrived. And they were there for a few weeks. The first couple of weeks were interesting because Ferrolana was in town, and there was a lot of festivities associated with the Ferrolana.
Well, I'd want to get down here and have a look at a Spanish warship. That would be the first thing.
Indeed. And Quesada, the brigadier captain, he went up town to sail over the governor and to pay his respects to the military leaders and to the Catholic bishop, and extended hospitality on board ship to the notables of Fremantle and beyond. He was getting a bit testy because he needed water and food supplies for his ship, and the Fremantle merchants, Samson and the rest of them, were saw an opportunity here.
and wouldn't you?
And water was sold to the captain at prices that he could not really believe that he was being charged, and left with the task of having to pay them. And food and the rest of his supplies that he needed, he was having to pay a lot of money to the Fremantle traders. Nonetheless, in good grace, the captain welcomed a lot of these people on board his ship to celebrate their presence, and they in turn reciprocated with a big festival ball event up in town in Perth at Renane's hotel on the terrace. It was a ballroom that they decorated, and they asked the captain to borrow his flag, and he was a bit reluctant, but he sent the flag up, and it was used in the ballroom. It was to be the night before he was going to leave. He was very keen to leave Fremantle with his supplies and get up to Philippines, where his brother was in charge of the defence forces of Spain in the Philippines. And anyway, Quesada was keen to get out of town. But as he was wanting to, haul up an anchor, whatever the expression is, he realised he didn't have his flag. The flag was still in the ballroom. So he had to send up some of these men to go and retrieve the flag, slowed him down a bit. And then he discovers that he's short three crew.
Short three crew. They've had such a good time. They think this is a good place to stay, do they?
Indeed. So that three of his Spanish crew had deserted, and he's enlisted the support of the Fremantle police unsuccessfully to try and find where these three guys were. They effectively disappear into history. But I've spent a bit of time trying to track them down. There is a couple of potential names, but it's speculative rather than... he eventually gives up on the crew, but having his flag on the back of the ship, a pretty big flag, he ups anchor. Interestingly enough, he takes with him one of the missionaries who won't get off the ship.
Oh, what? So desertion goes both ways.
So on the ship out, as your listeners will read in the diary, things got pretty testy amongst the missionary crew.
That's on the way from Cadiz to here.
Yeah.
They got testy about what? What they were saying mass the wrong way.
In a variety of issues, including disputes over the saying of mass. There was a chaplain on board the ship, and the captain thought that that was a perfectly sufficient to meet the needs of the ship. But Bishop Sarah and his fellow priests and missionaries had other ideas, and things started to fall apart. There was an Irishman, a very troublesome Irishman on board that had been recruited.
That's an oxymoron, Tom.
I'm full-blood Irish. I won't have you say that. The Irishman was troublesome and a bad recruit, and his name was Dominic Urquhart.
Good Urquhart. There's been plenty of them around the West.
he caused trouble. And I think there's a couple of combinations here. That Sarah himself was a troubled personality, a bit impressed by the fact that he'd been made a bishop, and not too impressed by having orders thrown at him by the captain. Things got difficult on board ship, and some of the mission equipment was stolen by one of the crew members. You see it all in the diary.
Yeah. So this is amazing. This fellow, our diarist, Marcer, he must have been quite an educated fellow.
Indeed. Although he came from an agricultural family, farming family, he was a family that were well connected there in Barcelona. I suspect it might have been connection that came in part from his chosen career as a printer. And he worked with a man who I think his correct pronunciation of his surname is Bocabilla. But a man that was ran an important printing outfit. Bocabilla was very instrumental in the thought work that had gone into getting a site ready many decades later to what we're talking about here for the famous Basilica of Sagrada Familia in
Sagrada Familia. Yeah. I mean, everyone who's gone to Spain has got down very quickly to Barcelona to see what a magnificent setup.
Indeed. And so that's the sort of connection that this ship and the diarist is leading and has fascinated anyone that comes across the diary to see these links back into Spain and to...
Particularly in the Catalan community. But these guys arrive here. All but one of the intended missionaries get off the ship. Another one stays there or tows it back there. Three of the crew head bush or wherever, change their Catalan names to Brown, Smith and Stevens and get away with it. But what happens to them then after they get looked after and wined and dined here in Henry Street? Do they get the next Uber up to New Norcia?
No, they're left with the task, firstly, of having to go up on foot with equipment. Initially, a group of them go up to assist Bishop Sarah in celebrating a mass up in the what was then the little cathedral on Victoria Avenue, St. John the Evangelist Cathedral, still there now as a pro-cathedral little building.
Right next to St. Mary's Cathedral.
It's just across the road, down the road from Victoria Square, yeah. A little heritage building that's the earliest Catholic cathedral in Perth. But they go up there and assist Sarah for that mass. They come back down there. This is all on foot. Fortunately, after the Ferrolana leaves, after Ferrolana leaves, the boat is available to take them up river, the little river boats, and they go up with their goods, most of their goods that haven't gone by wagon, and get ready up there in Perth for their big overland trek, which starts in late January. For their walk up with the wagon loads of supplies, huge volume of stores and supplies.
It's a great undertaking, of course. Both Sarah and Salvato and the existing missionaries had become familiar with the route, but still they had to get up there. And do they go straight away?
After 2 weeks of preparations in Perth, they get underway. One of their bullocks drays breaks down on the way across the causeway. But eventually they get underway and they get up to New Norcia as a group. They haven't all gone. Dissent has broken out and they've lost another five missionaries that have sort of joined in other work in Perth. One of them, the Irishman's become the Vicar General for Bishop Brady, and others have stayed with the diocese rather than go up to New Norcia.
So they had, in a sense, plenty of job opportunities. Having got here, they got the lie of the land and decided what they were going to do with themselves.
So they get to New Norcia eventually after walking up there, and they're starting vigorously to establish a monastery. Unfortunately, disputes broken out in the Catholic community between the two bishops, Sarah and Brady. A completely pathetic mismatch of personalities and nationalities, and Bishop Brady is unhappy with the assignment to his diocese of Sarah, and so he jumps on a boat to go back to Europe to plead his case to Rome. This is all before what they call a synodal church, where local decision making could be taken. Everything has to be decided back in Rome.
So Brady heads off to Rome.
He heads.
Brady's got his own, as I recall, fascinating history. Was he an even tempered fellow who was selfless in his endeavours?
Well, unfortunately, he was a complex Irishman, and
he signed Urquhart up pretty quickly.
He did, a fellow Irishman, but. I think Brady was personally, from what you're reading the history, Brady was a complex person. I would have thought he was not well, and his temperament was not good. He clashed with the Mercy Sisters. He clashed with his fellow priests, and certainly clashed with Sarah. He jumped on a boat to try to get Sarah removed by Rome. And left in charge while he was away Urquhart, who had already shown his colours to be against the Benedictine endeavour. Urquhart had this very interesting view that he'd joined to be a missionary monk, but argued that monks could never be missionaries. It was a very strange dispute that he was engaged in, but he sent up a gun party up to New Norcia and drove the Benedictines away from New Norcia at gunpoint. And they, as the diary records, they packed up all their stuff again and headed down from New Norcia down to Guildford, where they rented some properties and set up a place right on the area there, just on. It's now occupied by the Catholic Homes there. It's a aged care facility. It's got old olive trees that the monks planted, and that's where they were for about 12 months, by which time Rome was getting a handle on Brady and had told him to go packing, and Sarah was then left with full authority. So Sarah moved his monks into town, on Victoria Avenue, but a cluster of them he sent to the Lakes District of Perth, which was that we would now see it as the inner northwest of Perth. The lakes were those Herdsman and Gallup Lakes, and he established there his monastery, Sarah's new monastery called New Subiaco.
Isn't it just fantastic? Subiaco,
yeah,
and
Subiaco.
Nocia.
Yeah.
They bring their, like we did with everybody else's names, except for the Noongar names around here. We imported the names, we put new in front of it, although Subiaco today has lost the new. Norcia has the new in front of it, but they're there for all to see. So how long did all that go on, and when did they get back to New Norcia?
So they were there for a few years, those that stayed on. They worked from Subiaco, fanned out, did the walk into Victoria Avenue and to Victoria Square, some down to Fremantle to help build the church, the first church, which I think was on Parry and the corner of not far from where the Catholic Church is.
Well, I think Adelaide Street, probably.
That's right, Adelaide and Parry. And that was work that was under the care of one of the monks that came on the boat, Ascione, a Neapolitan, a very skilled architect and builder who came on Ferrolana. He had a lot of labour with him that were reassigned from New Norcia down to do this work. The group were effectively working out of New Norcia up until about 1864. So that's a good long stint, by which time Salvato was eventually able to persuade Rome to allow New Norcia to be its own separate diocese, a separate monastic diocese, and Salvato was left as the abbot bishop in charge of New Norcia, and he was in turn able to persuade the monks, those monks that had stayed on at New Subiaco, to go join him up at up in New Norcia, by which time they'd lost a large number of their personnel to other mission fields, back to Europe. A number of them went off and became monks and religious and priests in other circumstances, including the diarist, who went back to Barcelona and became a priest and lived his life as a priest in the neighbouring parish to the church from which he had been robed in 1849. But they went all over the place. 15 of them stayed as Benedictines associated with the New Norcia Monastery. Others, for instance, the next Bishop of Perth, Martin Griver, who came on the boat, he stayed as a diocesan priest and became the Bishop of Perth. He and others followed different pathways, but two young men died as soon after they arrived, Rodriguez and Resch, one buried in East Perth and the other one in Subiaco. But up in the graveyard at New Norcia, the 13 graves of men that came off this ship that lived their lives as Benedictines to the rest of their days, the last of them died there was a monk, it died in 1904, a bloke called Brier, Brother Brier, and the fascinating about these names is they changed over time because they start off being recorded either as Castilian or a Catalan or in a Neapolitan Italian, and then they were firstly Latinized and then Anglicized and then nicknames as well. So anyone trying to work their way through a diary is left with these changing nomenclature that applies to these guys, but I've been able to track the 40 of them down. I know where each of them pretty well ended up, and there's so many tales from this diary, including stories that emerge from here of men like Perajuan, which is a name that's woven into the West Australian population. There are police officer Perajuans and an artist Perajuan. The Bolladeras name, they're a very distinguished family. There's an Aboriginal people that carry that name as well. Ferraras, and one of the names that with which I'm associated is the Rotorita name. Again, about 300 people carry that surname across Australia, all descendants of one of the people off this boat.
Tom, this story, as you continue to tell it, just becomes more and more interesting. You've obviously devoted a tremendous amount of time, but I can see why. It's every page of the diary must throw something up. So what do you discover when you start pouring into the diaries? Are there graphics? Are there lists? Are there interesting little anecdotes? Is it a dry account of what happened Monday, Tuesday to Friday? What happens?
Well, there's all of those things, absolutely all of them. I think that you'd sense perhaps rabbit holes, in a sense, that open up in front of you. I mean, for me, the sense... I've had this memory, Michael, of the Perth Festival once putting on a performance of a street theatre, if you like. It was called The Angel Project, and it gave me the chance to walk through the streets and experience the city with personalities walking beside you that were angelic. The diary, if you like, has for me positioned around Western Australia in Fremantle and in the streets of Perth, these personalities that were on board ship and what they were up to. And so I can no longer come to Fremantle or visit Fremantle or walk around some parts of Perth without thinking about these guys that had got off that ship. Not least of all because, if you go to Cottesloe, you have to go across streets that are named Salvado or Rosendo or Griver. These are all names associated with this story. And then if you go up to Subiaco, you obviously have Salvado Road, and you end up being caught up in the sense of the personalities. Ferrolana is the name of a street down south of Fremantle, or up in, there's two places where the streets carry the name Ferrolana. And for me, this diary has helped me understand and appreciate the names that have landed on the, in the case of the Subiaco name, for instance, it's been a moving suburb. It started as a monastery in the location which is now Herdsman's Lake, Herdsman Tavern. But, you know, that a peripatetic name that moved up and landed on a railway station and eventually a suburb that goes all the way down to the Swan. The name migrated. Likewise, the lands were for a time not only called the Lakes District, they were called Churchlands. And that name, as well as the church ownership of the land diminished, the name migrated to a suburb, to land on a suburb at some on the other side of Herdsman Lake. It brings to life the history of Western Australia and why these names have landed. How did they come, and who do they reference? And in Fremantle, there's so many stories from this diary. They include Master looking after a Chinese guy in the colonial hospital, and he talks about this young man dying, and you look at and try and find, who is this guy? He turns out to be an indentured labourer that has come down to Fremantle a couple of years before, and then you suddenly find his funeral's being attended by 20 Chinese people that have come up from Fremantle to his funeral in Perth, wearing white traditional Chinese funeral attire. So the diary opens up a sense of, my goodness, are there that many Chinese people here? How do they get here? The governor, Irwin, brought them down. He got a couple of indentured labourers to work for himself, and the Cathy Bishop got one, and George Fletcher Moore got two, and John Septimus Roe got two. And that's all part of our colonial story, which these men now are the next part, that arrive with Marsa. They are the first really very large group of non-English speakers to arrive in Western Australia, harbingers, if you like, of the multicultural society that we've become. But at that time, it was an English-speaking dominant society. There were some Irish Gaelic speakers, but mostly English speakers. And this group were able to find their way either through their monastic connection or for many of them in their way that they wove themselves into the economic life of the community by taking up various trades that were much needed within the early colonial settlement. The story is fascinating for a whole range of additional reasons. Ferrolana, before it even takes off from Spain with the missionaries on board, it's connected immediately to a piece of history that just fascinates me, which is a dead king of Sardinia is brought down and his body's on a ship that with his son, and the captain brings the king's son on board and shows him respect. Well, that young son turns out to be later King Victor Emmanuel II of Italy, of the United Italy, that the Ferrolana has just been over trying to protect the Pope from the United Italy, and now its next job is looking after Victor Emmanuel, who becomes the first king of the United Italy. That king's son is a bloke called Amadeus, who becomes a king of Spain on after Isabella II has to flee and go to Paris. And the connection of this ship that's firing bullets or firing cannons here in Fremantle opens up a world which, for me, I have found educative, and I'm sure the readers will find it just as educative, that it connects Western Australia, it connects Fremantle to a world that is unique enough at New Norcia, but through that New Norcia connection to a global experience. Ferralana.
Just amazing, Tom. You don't have to, I tell you, convince the editor of the Fremantle Shipping News about the importance of ship names. You could just study them and study world history, indeed. I reckon. So tell our listeners what happened to the Ferralana after she left here with one extra missionary on board and three less crew members. You say she went, captain took her off to visit his brother up in the Philippines, and it was on a circumnavigation. Did it ever finish?
It did. So the missionary got off in the Philippines and became a famous bell-making family in the Philippines. And they had a successful visit to the Philippines. They went up to Hong Kong and up into China, and they crossed down to India from Calcutta. They came right down into the southern part of the Indian Ocean, and then got the winds that took them all the way through south of Australia until they cut up into Sydney, a grand arrival in Sydney, and then from Sydney across to Callao over in South America, and travelled around the various parts of South America with great celebrity, great festivity, great show of diplomacy, and eventually headed back into Cadiz after nearly 2.5 years.
Certainly, way you can look at history, New Norcia really is just a small, faint footnote in the story of the Ferralana.
There's a bit of that. I've become a bit focused in on Ferralana for a whole range of reasons, not least of which, you know, it turns up again, firing shots at the American mail ship, the El Dorado, because it was coming too close, in their view, to Cuba off the coast of Havana. It fascinates me because you immediately get immersed in a story that has contemporary relevance, where in international waters, the Spanish are firing on a US boat, and the Yanks got pretty upset to the point where they withdrew their diplomats from Madrid. Spain was still reasonably powerful, but it was a while before the Spanish-American war broke out. But here we are, we're in international politics and international affairs and maritime law. We've now got the Yanks shooting Venezuelan boats out in international waters in complete contradistinction to the argument that they were running when the Ferralana was firing shots at them.
Well, fortunately, the American whaler, the Catawba, didn't get chased by the colonial authorities here. That's another story, Tom. It's been wonderful talking to you about this. People will want to know how to get it. And how do they get a copy of Master's Diary?
So it's Abbey Press. Abbey Press is owned by New Norcia Monastery, and they are launching the book at New Norcia at their Library Day in October 17th. We'll have a smaller metro launch at the Cathedral on the 18th of October. But beyond that, the New Norcia Museum store will be the sale point for Abbey Press and the Master Diary.
Well, you might have to get some in a new edition here in Fremantle. I think our listeners will be rushing in. And the last thing everybody will want to know, because they'll see an image of the front cover of the Master Diary, what's that image all about?
The image is a lithograph that was utilised by Salvado when he was back in Europe writing his memoirs of his first couple of years in New Norcia and wanting to have some illustrations that would inspire the faithful across Europe to be generous with personnel and other resources that would equip the New Norcia Monastic Foundation to be able to do their job. So this lithograph is a imagined sketch of the way New Norcia was it's a clearly idealistic depiction of rather grand mountain.
Snow-covered mountains.
But it's got some of the idea of the monks of New Norcia starting their early establishment of a monastic town, a unique town, the only monastic town that was ever established in Western Australia or in Australia.
Tom Stevens, thanks for coming in, telling us about the book. People are going to find it fascinating. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.